From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As former director of the Congressional Budget Office, Douglas Holtz Aiken says he had the dubious honor of presiding over the largest dollar deficits in federal history. But he insists it's not his fault. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Holtz Aiken about the analysis he gave Congress as war spending increased, a new Medicare benefit was created, and taxes were cut. When he resigned in December, he was praised in New York Times and Washington Post editorials for remaining nonpartisan in the partisan world of Washington. We'll ask him how he did it. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Arthur and George, the new novel by Julian Barnes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let me read what editorials in The Washington Post and New York Times had to say when my guest Douglas Holtz Aiken left his position as executive director of the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, in December. That's the office that prices proposed legislation and analyzes its economic impact. The Post wrote, "When Douglas Holtz Aiken was named to head the CBO, we were a bit jittery. Mr. Holtz Aiken was going to the nonpartisan budget office from his stint as the White House chief economist. Now he is leaving, and we're sorry to see him go. He's been an honest and clear-thinking director who has resisted political pressures to skew or sugarcoat the difficult policy choices confronting Congress." The New York Times editorial said, "Often what Mr. Holtz Aiken said wasn't what his bosses wanted to hear. By going where the facts and figures led, Mr. Holtz Aiken also protected his agency, which may be the last bastion of neutral government analysis in Washington." Holtz Aiken resigned from the CBO in December, 3 years into his 4-year term. He's now at the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. We asked him to talk with us about remaining nonpartisan in a partisan world and to talk about the analysis he gave Congress on taxing and spending. Were you ever amazed at some of the creative ways that people in Congress spun your reports?
The ingenuity of the Congress and the staffs is limitless. And yes, I was amazed. I can't remember a specific one, but the art of spinning the numbers is really something that I came to admire in some sort of clinical and distant way. The numbers really don't ever speak for themselves. That's one of the, I think, interesting truisms that is just wrong in Washington, at least. The facts don't speak for themselves. People present the facts, and they spin them all the time.
So you can't think of one really good example of crazy spinning?
The tax ones are the best example. They always got attention, even if what I thought was a pretty straightforward analysis was being rolled out. There was attention paid to it, and it was spun in the most dramatic way. We did a piece on the estate tax and small businesses and farmers. I had worked on the estate tax as an academic. I believed it was widely known and appreciated by everyone that very few farms are actually sold in order to pay the estate tax, and that while this was a nice talking point, no one would really believe it. So I didn't really focus on this report. I thought, oh, this is something everyone knows. Out it came, immediate firestorm, and you get the spin on one side, which is the estate tax is this awful thing. And then you get the spin, interestingly enough, on exactly the same side. It says, well, the fact that they're not paying the estate tax, the fact that they're not selling the farm, means that they've already had to mess up their business operations so badly to make sure that they aren't big enough to pay the estate tax. It's bad either way. So it was ingenious spinning, and it was one I didn't really expect.
You were recently on NPR's Morning Edition, and you told Steve Inskeep, you said, "I have the dubious honor of presiding over the largest dollar deficits in federal history, and I promise you, it's not my fault." So what is it like to have been the head of the Congress?
I don't know why I say these things.
That's a great quote. So what is it like to have that dubious honor?
I get teased a lot, that's for sure. There's some people who think it is my fault, who would either write or call and say, you know, why are you doing this? And I'd have to explain gently that while I added them up, I didn't make the choices that gave us those results. In the end, it's hard sometimes to look at the fiscal picture, which I think has some serious challenges, to see them going unaddressed and to be in a position where you think your advice is something that is important and might actually change things. But it's a lesson in that what really matters are the voters, and that's appropriate. You can get too caught up in your own importance in Washington, and one of the things I learned was that's a danger.
Were there times when you felt like you were watching us getting deeper and deeper and deeper into debt? You were holding up the numbers, you were issuing the reports about how policies were getting us even deeper into debt, and it wasn't, well, it didn't matter.
I don't ever think it didn't matter, to be honest. And I get asked a lot whether members of Congress understand what's going on with the budget, whether they understand the kinds of long-term challenges we face with Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security? And the answer is yes, they do. And I'm, in the end, a great fan of Congress. I have a lot of fondness for the Congress and a deep respect for the talents that are in the Congress. But there is a public version of this, and it's a place where the widely discussed partisanship really does come into play, where members are sticking to their talking points, sticking to a message, and it gives the public the impression they are either unaware or uncaring about the outlook, when that's really not actually the case.
The president would like to continue his program of tax cuts. Can you sum up your warnings about how the debt will increase if we continue to cut taxes without significantly decreasing our spending?
The easiest way to imagine the future is to just suppose we go on fiscal autopilot and change nothing from where we are now. The really dramatic growth will be on the spending side. As the baby boom retires and there are more individuals eligible for the old age programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those programs will grow dramatically. Social Security right now, benefits are about 4.5 cents out of every national dollar. And in the next several decades, that will rise to 6.5 cents, so it'll go up by about 50%, and then ultimately get to about 7 cents on the national dollar. So that program, which is our single largest program, will get 50 to 60% bigger. That's the good news. Medicare and Medicaid, currently also about 4 cents on the national dollar, will grow easily to 12%, 12 cents on our national dollar, triple in size, and may get bigger depending on how fast healthcare costs grow up. So given that kind of spending pressure, it certainly is the case that you cannot continue to lower the amount of money coming into the federal government. And even if you raise taxes, it may be the case that we can't keep up with the spending growth. So it's really important to get these two sides of the budget to talk to each other and to form a coherent plan. I think the fairest characterization of what's going on at the moment is nobody is looking at the complete picture. Some people are looking at taxes, some are looking at war costs, some are focused on Social Security, others on Medicare, but it really doesn't add up in a coherent planning fashion, which is what the budget is supposed to be.
This is the first time, as far as I understand it, that we've cut taxes during wartime. What does the math look like paying for Iraq while cutting taxes?
In the end, the income tax cuts that people have focused on, 2001, 2003 especially, constitute about 1.5, maybe 2 cents in the national dollar. I think that's the easiest way to get your head around how much money is at stake. Iraq and Afghanistan war costs are running on the order of $60 to $70 billion a year. That's a half a cent on the national dollar. If you count in some broader costs, you might get up to a penny if you include additional benefits that the returning servicemen will get and the costs associated with medical care for those who are harmed while at war. So certainly if you do that horse race, the tax reductions versus the Iraq war costs, you can make a fiscal case. You can't make the tax cuts match up with the broader problem. They aren't big enough to take care of Social Security. They aren't even close to the Medicare problem. So, again, one of my frustrations in listening to the talk around Washington for the past couple of years has been the nearly exclusive focus on taxes. And in the end, if you spend the money, you're going to pay for it one way or another. And to talk about taxes when the real action is on what the government does, how much does it spend, where does it spend it, is, I think, very incomplete and very misleading.
Can you make the connection for us, the amount of money that the tax cuts take out of the budget with the amount of money that the war adds to the budget? Like, can you put the equal sign there and add that up for us?
Certainly. From a narrow budget perspective, the war adds, say, on the order of $100 billion to the federal budget, probably a little bit less. The tax cuts, they're easily twice, maybe three times that, depending on the year in which it takes place. So it's real clear that the tax cuts are bigger than the war costs from a straight budget perspective. The the caveat that always has to come in from an economics perspective is whether the broad swing in the budget, the swing from a surplus to a deficit, had additional ramifications above and beyond just what the federal budget looked like. And the answer is, yes, it did. The economy was very weak in the early part of this century. And in the absence of the genuine stimulus that came from the federal budget, we probably would not have come out of the recession as well. And we were the sole source of growth in the global economy. And so the global economy would have suffered somewhat. So it's hard to stop at just the budget, because there really are ramifications in economic policy and indeed broader international policy that go beyond how it adds up in the budget.
So are you saying you have a kind of mixed review of the tax cuts? You think on the one hand it stimulated the economy, which was good. On the other hand, it's making it much harder to pay for the war in Iraq?
It certainly makes it harder to pay for things, but there were benefits as well. And the difference between looking back, where the economy was weak and we certainly needed to do some things to put our economic house in order and survive the recession and the war, versus looking forward, where the economy is now recovered, things are in pretty good shape, and we have these big spending plans and not enough revenue to cover them. Those are two very different pictures.
So what advice would you have about the wisdom of continuing the tax cuts now, which is what the president would like to do?
The central issue, and this is how it always breaks out, is how big a government does the United States want? If the current tax laws are kept in place, we will raise about 18% of national income and federal taxes. That's business as usual in the United States. We always spend about 20 cents on the dollar, raise about 18 cents on the dollar in taxes, and borrow the remaining two. That's how the federal government has been essentially for the entire post-war. If we keep the current tax code,
post-World War II.
Okay. Pretty much on average. Current tax code would raise about 18 cents on the national dollar. So it would keep us at business as usual. The real issue is whether that will be enough to cover the bills, because we are on track to have much more than the typical 20 cents in spending. We're on track to go toward 30 cents in spending. So it's really an issue of just how much you care about controlling the spending side. If you don't, then it's impossible to imagine this current tax code will survive.
My guest is Douglas Holtz Aiken, and he resigned just a few weeks ago as the director of the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Holtz Aiken, and he recently resigned from his position as director of the Congressional Budget Office, and he's now with the Council on Foreign Relations, a think tank. Well, there were spending cuts made by Congress, and many of those cuts were in programs like, you know, Medicaid, food stamps, student aid and loan programs, daycare subsidies. What kind of dent does that kind of spending make on the larger problem of the debt that we face and that we're going to continue to face, the debt that's going to keep growing?
None. Those cuts are politically painful, evidently, and symbolic in nature. They are tiny. They are $40 billion over 5 years. That's $8 billion a year. We have a $2.2 trillion spending budget. This is pennies and doesn't even come close to the kinds of problems that we face.
So why do you think they were targeted, you know, as the places that were cut? And, you know, Congressman saying, well, look, you know, we've got tough choices to make, so these are the programs we're going to cut.
I think if you look at the places where the money is, the big money is number one in Social Security. We had been through a year of Social Security debate. I don't think anyone in Congress had the appetite to touch that again. Number two, they are in Medicare and Medicaid to a smaller degree, because the states pick up part of the cost there. So in the presence of the prescription drug benefit and the heat that surrounded the expansion of Medicare, That's another area where the Congress, I think, was loath to go again. Third big spending item is defense. It's impossible to imagine cutting the operating budget for overseas operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's difficult to imagine cutting the baseline defense budget when you're at war. So if you take off the table all the places where the money is, what you're left with are the kinds of programs that got targeted. And there's not a lot of money there, but there was certainly a tremendous amount of contention over whether it was worth doing at all.
So tell me if this is an unfair description. I think what you're saying is that Medicaid, food stamps, student aid and load programs, daycare subsidies were cut in the name of helping to balance the budget, but really it's not going to help at all. But the people who were recipients of those programs are paying the price.
I'd agree up to the point where you say it's the recipients of the programs who are paying the price. For example, student loans, a big chunk of the reductions were intended to come out of lenders in the student loan program. Those banks who make student loans get guarantees from the government and make a hefty profit on those loans. There was an attempt to carve that back. That strikes me as a sensible thing to do. In some cases, particularly in Medicaid, the focus was on the cost of drugs, and there the attempt was to make sure that manufacturers of drugs paid greater rebates back to the federal government. That's more money being given to the federal government. It counts as negative spending in the magic of federal budgeting, so that's a spending cut. The broad characterization, I think, you have to be careful with. Program by program, there are places where I know there are legitimate concerns, but as a general characterization, not all the recipients are the ones at risk.
Let me ask you another question about cutting taxes. And this gets more into opinion rather than, you know, just like a cold look at the numbers. But some critics of the tax cuts say that the staunchest advocates of the tax cuts, who have been very effective in advocating their plan, advocated for one of two reasons. One is that they are ideologically committed to tax cuts as being like the cure for everything, or two, that the advocates represent the wealthy or represent big business, which would stand to benefit from the tax cuts. I don't know if you want to get into that level of opinion or not, but from your perspective, having crunched the numbers, knowing the people in Congress, trying to make all the arguments and all the numbers add up, what would you say to those critics?
There's a grain of truth to some of it, and I think some of it is not on the mark. There are those who believe that tax cuts are the cure for everything, and I don't have much sympathy for that viewpoint. Number one, as I told members of Congress when I took the CBO job, not all tax cuts are created equal. Removing a dollar from the tax code by cutting the top marginal tax rate and removing a dollar from the tax code by having a health insurance tax credit and removing a dollar from the tax code by fixing the alternative minimum tax are all three very different things. And so the notion that somehow just cutting taxes, regardless of how you do it, is uniformly going to solve your problems is just misplaced. I have very little sympathy for that. There's another line of reasoning that really comes down to the point that I made earlier about how big do you want the government to be, and there's some advocates of the tax cuts, who really wanted to keep the federal government's share of national income at 18%. That's that. We don't want a bigger government, so we're going to hold the line on that 18%, and this becomes the starve the beast theory, where if that's the money coming in, eventually the beast has to live on 18%, and you're done. We haven't lived on 18%, so I think that you have to cast some doubt over whether that's going to work. And then the third piece is this fairness issue. And the part that I find frustrating about that is that this is not your grandfather's income tax. There's still a widespread perception that, as in the 1960s and even the 1970s, the income tax is a very broad-based revenue raiser that affects all Americans. That's no longer true. The income tax has slowly but surely been adjusted to remove lower and lower income individuals from the tax rolls entirely. And at this point, the bottom one half of Americans pays only 5% of the taxes. The bottom quarter pays none at all. So the income tax is really a tax on rich people. It's on the top 50% for sure, and the top 5% pay half the taxes. And so I cannot imagine how you could have a tax cut using the income tax that's fair, because there are so many people that aren't on it at all. And it will, in the end, always be tilted toward the upper-income folks. And that's a fact of life that I think Americans need to come to terms with.
If there were a new office that was created called the Congressional Office on How to Have an Honest and Meaningful Debate on Taxing and Spending, without spin, how would you, just to kind of sum up, frame the debate you think we should be having about taxes?
I would frame up debate by talking about what we should have on spending. I think we need to decide how much we will devote to old age programs in America. How much will we have in the way of retirement income support, health insurance and health care support, long-term care support, nursing home support? What will that look like? We are moving to a world in which there will be more old people. The baby boom will retire. 1 year goes by each year without fail, and people get older as a result. So that's coming. It's plain as day. We need to accept that fact, put together a set of programs that we believe are sensible programs for the 21st century, and then come up with the money to pay for them. But to talk about taxes without deciding what we're going to be paying for gets the cart before the horse. And it is my biggest frustration with the way Washington has done business in the past 5 years.
Douglas Holtz Agin spent 3 years as the director of the Congressional Budget Office. He resigned in December and is now with the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. From Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Emancipator's Wife, a novel of Mary Todd Lincoln by Barbara Hambly. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why Social Security may be easier to reform than Medicare. We continue our conversation with Douglas Holtz Agin, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Arthur and George, the new novel by Julian Barnes, based on an incident in the life of Arthur Conan Doyle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Douglas Holtz Agin. He served 3 years as the director of the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. It's the office that determines how much money the government is spending and taking in and estimates the costs of proposed legislation. The CBO is not supposed to make policy recommendations. When Holtz Agin resigned in December, he was praised in Washington Post and New York Times editorials for remaining nonpartisan. He formerly served as the chief economist on President Bush's Council of Economic Advisers. Let's talk a little bit about the spending on the war in Iraq. Now, a lot of the money we're spending isn't included in the actual budget. It's coming under the category of supplemental spending. What does that mean?
In the end, it means that it shows up in the budget after the fact without fail. Nothing can escape the fact that to get payment, it has to go through the U.S. Treasury. So it is in the budget in that sense. However, when the president proposes a budget at the beginning of each year, this administration has chosen not to put the costs of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan in the base budget. They've left it out entirely, sent the budget up to Congress, and then Congress has begun its deliberations on how much it wants to spend on different things in the absence of that piece of information. So if you think of the budget as a planning document trying to weigh the costs of various different national needs, it's been left out of that planning process. Now, Congress has tried to fill this gap to some extent by putting an allowance in their budgetary plans for the costs, but the administration is uniquely positioned to know how much the war is likely to cost during a year. It has knowledge of its desires in terms of the number of troops that are overseas and the scale of the effort that will be necessary, and that's not been brought into the budgetary process.
So what is the logic of leaving it out, or what are the motives of leaving it out of the actual budget and keeping it a supplemental spending?
The idea of a supplemental spending bill is typically an emergency. Something has arisen that was not possible to plan for at the beginning of the year, and the defense of leaving it out of the federal budget comes in two forms. One, we don't really know what it will cost in a year in Iraq, and I think that there are situations where that was defensible. After the initial invasion, I don't think anyone had a great feel for how long the United States would be there or how many troops would be necessary. And in those circumstances, coming up with a number to put in the budget would be very hard. And that's been one defense. As time has passed, I think that defense has gotten weaker and weaker. And the Pentagon has been fairly public about its plans for troop rotations, and one could budget based on those plans. The second is really a political argument that says if we put it in the budget, we'll raise the base defense budget and it'll never come out. And that one, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for. If we can make the decision to raise spending, we can make the decision to lower spending as well.
Is this does this kind of supplemental spending for the war create an illusion that we're in better fiscal shape than we really are? Because when the budget, the full debt of the war does not show up in the official budget.
It doesn't create that illusion. In fiscal year 2005, the last year for which the government closed its books, money coming in was short of money going out by $319 billion. And included in the money going out were the costs of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So in the end, the books show the full cost of everything the government does. The question is, at what point does that enter into the bookkeeping? And the administration has chosen to take it out of the first couple of steps.
One of your responsibilities when you were head of the Congressional Budget Office was to review all the money that was spent in Iraq. And this week, the Office of the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction issued a new audit of our spending in Iraq, and it found fraud and incompetence. Money was paid for projects that were never completed. Millions of dollars were just kept in the living and working quarters of Americans and were never kept track of. Now, you know, Paul Bremer, who's been on a book tour and was on our show as well as many others, has said that you couldn't do the kind of accounting that the Inspector General Office wanted because there were things you had to pay for in a hurry. There's a war around you. You can't do. It's hard to do all the administrative work and so on. But I'm wondering, like, from your point of view, having approved all the money going into Iraq and then reading this report and seeing the level of fraud and incompetence reported, what goes through your mind?
I haven't read the report, I'll be honest. So I don't know either the degree to which the dollars were frittered away in ways that seem undesirable or you know, exactly what the list was. I think it's important in defense of these kinds of findings to recognize that when the government tries to do reconstruction in Iraq, or when the government tries to do recovery from hurricanes, whether we be Katrina, Rita, Wilma, or going back, Hurricane Andrew, if you give people on the ground the authority to spend money and say, you know the situation, do your best, after the fact, you're going to find situations where they made the wrong call. And you're going to find situations that look, in some cases, absolutely silly, or you bought trailers, or you undertook a restoration project that made no sense. So I'm a little bit forgiving of the notion that it's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback sitting in an office in Washington. I'm not sitting on the ground in a war zone. With that caveat aside, it's the taxpayers' money. We have to spend it wisely. And one of the things that I've learned is that you need to prepare extensively to make sure that when people go into a situation like this and you give them the authority, they also have the right reflexes, the right training. They've drawn the experience of past operations in Bosnia, Kosovo, and a variety of other areas so that we don't waste the money, despite the natural pressures that lead to that. And I think this kind of report is testament to that, that not enough anticipation was in place about the kinds of pressures that would come to bear on an Iraq reconstruction.
My guest is Douglas Holtz Aiken. He headed the Congressional Budget Office for 3 years and resigned in December. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let me reintroduce you for our listeners just joining us. My guest is Douglas Holtz Aiken, and just a few weeks ago, he resigned from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. He was the director of the office. He's now with the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. You were talking about the importance of us as a nation figuring out what our priorities are in spending when it comes to Social Security, you know, health insurance, Medicare, and then figuring out what is it going to take for us to get enough money to pay for those programs. So let's talk a little bit about the tough choices that had to be made about entitlements. You said you think Social Security is easier to fix than Medicare. Why?
Social Security is just money. Not to be cynical or trite about it, but it's much simpler when a program just involves dollars. Social Security picks up money in one part of the economy, transfers it to another part of the economy. It has taxes. It has benefits. It's a pretty straightforward program. It's been around for 70 years. Its problems are fundamentally driven by the demography, the fact that we're getting older as a nation. So its problems are well understood, well diagnosed. And there's a big menu of fixes, regardless of whether you would like to have individual accounts in or not like to have individual accounts in, whether you prefer higher taxes or lower benefits. They're big menus. This is an easy-to-solve policy problem. Healthcare is very different. And Medicare and Medicaid are built on our underlying healthcare challenges, and those involve very difficult ethical issues. Access to the best technologies. Is it appropriate that everyone should get the same thing regardless of their ability to pay? How do we handle end-of-life expenditures, and what are the ethical norms there? And healthcare costs are rising. In America, costs have outstripped the growth of income by 2.5% per year. And so if you think of income as the well from which you can draw resources to pay the bills, and you look at costs going up 2.5% faster every year than the well is getting filled, you've got a big problem. That's a lot harder to solve than Social Security. So I think it'd be useful for us to do Social Security first, put it on a sound footing, remove the uncertainty, everyone will know the deal for their retirement, and then move on to the much more difficult challenge of healthcare in America.
Does the president's plan of privatizing Social Security accounts help solve the Social Security deficit that we are likely to face a little down the line as the baby boom retires?
No. Individual accounts are a policy decision. It might be the case that, and people disagree on this, but it might be the case that we decide that we want to have a Social Security system where individuals save at least in part for their own retirement. Right now, the Social Security system relies on taxing young people to pay for the retirements of old people. The old people do not save for their own retirement through Social Security. So we could decide to have a different system, one in which people saved at least in part for their own retirement. But in doing that, the current young workers would have to save for their own retirements, but they also have to pay for the old people's retirements, so they're going to get hit twice. And that doesn't make financing it any easier. It actually makes it harder. So Individual counts are an important policy issue. They're worthy of an extensive debate, but they're not a solution to Social Security's financial problems at all.
Are there, like, tune-ups we could do without overhauling the whole system that would help the math?
Certainly. There was a widely discussed proposal by a gentleman named Robert Posen in the past year, and that tune-up would take the form of changing the initial retirement benefit that individuals will get. So low-income individuals would get the same deal they get now, but high-income individuals would get smaller benefits in the future. They would only go up with the rate of inflation. Low-income workers' benefits would go up faster than that. The Posen plan by itself brings the gap between spending on Social Security and payroll taxes into alignment. Unfortunately, it only does it after, you know, 4 or 5 decades. So the question is, how do you accelerate the process to take care of the fact that the baby boom is starting to retire now? That would require something more dramatic in spending cuts or more taxes going in. But there are tweaks that make the system look entirely in alignment over the long term.
We were talking about Social Security. Let's look briefly at the new prescription drug benefit for Medicare. When you had to do an analysis for Congress on what this would mean, what did you find?
The CBO was asked at the time the bill was passed to estimate its cost. It was actually an unbelievable undertaking. It's hard to dial the clock back, but at the time, there was no such thing in the American market as an insurance benefit for outpatient prescription drugs. So that you couldn't go buy from any private insurer a policy that says, if I go to my doctor and he prescribes some drugs, that I'll have part of that cost covered. So we had to imagine a new product and firms competing to provide that product to 42 million seniors, the federal government picking up 75% of the tab, and just the enormous intricacy of the whole thing. Well, we took our best stab at it, said it would cost about $400 billion over the first 10 years. And I think it remains to be seen exactly whether that estimate is right or not. And our feeling at the time was it was obviously an estimate. We were, you know, almost certainly going to be wrong to some extent. And our goal was to put the estimate in the middle of the range, so we were just as likely to be too high as to be too low. And I think it'll be interesting to see in the next couple of months whether as many seniors sign up for this as the CBO originally anticipated. If not, it'll look cheaper, not more expensive, which has been the real focus of attention. Or if the seniors do sign up to the degree that the CBO did, you know, will it turn out to be more expensive than we thought? There's, at least for me, a little academic aspect to this, just seeing how we did, but there's a real life experience on the ground of just a very important expansion of the most important old age program in America.
Yeah, but if it's if fewer seniors sign up for the program and the program is therefore cheaper than you envisioned, it would be cheaper because people weren't using it. And if people aren't using it, it's probably because
it's
they're too
thing.
Confused, right?
I don't know the degree to which the confusion will persist.
Mm-hmm.
There's always, you know, a mixed blessing in numbers. The original concern was that not enough insurance firms would participate in this to get healthy competition, hold costs down. Now the concern is too many are participating, and the confusion in choosing is getting in the way. My guess is that after a year, we won't see 15 providers offering 5 different plans each. We'll see the number of providers weed itself out, and it'll come down. We'll see plans settling on a single program that they think is the best for their clients, and the choices will, in fact, become streamlined, and familiarity will really start to be more widespread. The beginning is clearly been a challenge for both sides, actually, both the seniors and for the drug companies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Douglas Holtz Aiken, and he spent 3 years as the head of the Congressional Budget Office. He resigned just a few weeks ago and is now with the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. When you left the Congressional Budget Office, the New York Times wrote an editorial praising you for your true nonpartisan research. And the editorial said, often what Mr. Holtz Aiken said wasn't what his bosses wanted to hear. Do you feel that that was so? And were there times when people said to you, hey, we thought you were on our team?
Oh, yeah. Certainly. But it wasn't just the Republicans who, you know, had in the end the power to appoint me. And the Democrats were also discontent at times, and that's the nature of the business. It is your job to tell people things that they sometimes just recognize will make their lives much more difficult, and hearing it out loud frustrates them. Sometimes it angers them. I guess one of the things that I've been uncomfortable with, although it's, you know, certainly very flattering to have important papers like the Washington Post, the New York Times write editorials saying, you know, good job, this merits special recognition. In the end, what I really did was my job, and I find it troubling that so much attention has been paid to something that should be commonplace. And if it is the case that simply doing one's jobs becomes such a rare event in Washington, then that's a depressing fact. I don't savor that very much. So this little, you know, episode of publicity is a mixed blessing to me. I sometimes feel that it's a sign of bad things, not really a good thing.
A sign of how partisan Washington has really become, that it's a big shock because yeah. Somebody can actually be nonpartisan.
Yeah, I find that troubling, in the end, it's the job, and hopefully I did it well. I would like to think I do jobs well. That's what you get up and go to work to do, is try to do a good job, but that's really what I thought I did, not more, and this makes it sound like it was more.
Mm-hmm. Why did you resign? It's a four-year term. You resigned after slightly less than three.
In the end, I had just a fabulous opportunity that I wanted to be able to take at the Council on Foreign Relations. The Council has a lot of the same attributes as the CBO. It's a nonpartisan organization. It is a think tank designed to produce research on policy issues to help inform the Congress, the administration, the public as a whole. That's the same mandate as CBO. It's broader in a way that I really found attractive. It is attempting to integrate thinking about economic policy into thinking about foreign policy so that you don't find situations where if you don't know the economics, you get the foreign policy wrong, or if you don't know foreign policy, you get the economics wrong. I found that really appealing, having been more narrowly concentrated on the economics for so many years. And it's clearly recognizing that there aren't any great lines between domestic issues and international issues anymore. Foreign policy is an international issue, not about just the Midwest. And so that kind of environment was attractive to me, and this opening might very well have gone away. So I took the chance. I greatly enjoyed my time at CBO, but sometimes there is an offer that you just feel you can't say no to, and this was one of those.
What do you and do you not miss about your job as head of the Congressional Budget Office?
There's a certain amount of withdrawal, not knowing what's going on. There's an enormous amount of information that flows through the CBO. The old truism that budget is policy is true. And as a result, you know a lot by keeping track of the budget. You find out a lot about what is being proposed and contemplated. And I miss that, that sense of having a feel for what's happening. The flip side is that I think an honest assessment is that after 5 years in government, two at the White House, three at the CBO, I am more tired than I realized. And I enjoy the notion that perhaps I could catch up a little bit on my sleep and have a little less pressure on a day-to-day basis. And I'm looking forward to that.
I find it really difficult to think in terms of trillions of anything.
I always try to think of this as fractions of our national dollars. These trillions are overwhelming. What does $2.2 trillion mean anyway?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm wondering. I was like, how do you deal with numbers of that magnitude?
I don't. But if I can at all avoid it, I try not to think of $2.2 trillion in revenue and $2.4 trillion in spending. I try to think of it as, okay, Americans get up, they go to work, they earn a buck. Out of that buck, government's going to spend 20 cents. It's going to take 18 in taxes, and we're going to borrow 2 cents. I always try to bring it back to that, out of every dollar, what are we doing? Otherwise, the numbers become too overwhelming to feel real.
Have you made out your taxes yet?
I'm in the midst of filling out my 2005 taxes, and that's always a good moment of reality, no question about it.
All right. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Douglas Holtz Aiken spent 3 years as the director of the Congressional Budget Office. He resigned in December and is now with the think tank, the Council on Foreign Relations. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new novel by Julian Barnes that's based on an incident in the life of Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes. This is Fresh Air. The award-winning writer Julian Barnes has just published a novel called Arthur and George that focuses on an incident in the life of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of the immortal detective Sherlock Holmes. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that Barnes' investigations and conclusions are far from elementary.
Julian Barnes' latest superb novel starts out in surprisingly plodding fashion. First, there are a few paragraphs devoted to Arthur, next a few paragraphs dutifully accorded to George, then Arthur, then George, Arthur, George, Arthur, George. The choppy two-step sets the pace for book one of this novel that Barnes calls, with a perverse devotion to literalness, Arthur and George, and it could trip up many a lesser writer. But Barnes' perceptions are so frequently startling, his language at once so precise and gorgeous, that the predictable narrative structure serves as a kind of necessary mental relief. And perhaps Barnes is also doffing his hat to Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of the title, who himself clung to the most mechanical of narratives in the Sherlock Holmes stories, and yet out of them created literary marvels. The Holmes stories, in their formulaic fashion, engage the big questions: the mystery of evil, the slippery quality of human identity, the elusive nature of truth. Those are the very same questions Barnes considers here in this moving novel that's based on an actual incident in the life of Arthur Conan Doyle. In 1901, or thereabouts, Barnes is deliberately hazy with dates, a 27-year-old solicitor at law named George Adelgee was arrested, tried, and convicted for savagely mutilating horses in the vicinity of his village outside Birmingham, England. Adelgee was sentenced to 7 years in prison, but only served three because the evidence against him was later deemed to be so shaky. For one thing, George Adelgee was, in the parlance of the day, a half-caste. His mother was Scottish, and his father, the vicar of the village, was Indian. Race prejudice was hinted at as a motive for his conviction. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle became involved in the case after George Adelgee's release. Despondent after the death of his first wife, Doyle publicly threw himself into the effort to secure a full pardon and a financial compensation for Adelgee, and in so doing, Doyle was instrumental in eventually getting the law allowing criminal appeal passed by Parliament. Tracking the faint footprints of the Adelgee case found in Doyle's autobiography, Barnes fleshes out a giant hound of a tale. In Arthur's sections, we follow the messy personal evolution of this great late Victorian writer, who even as he's penning the tales of ratiocination, of cool reason that would make him famous, is becoming more and more drawn into the world of the occult, experiments in table tapping, Ouija boards, and seances. Like many other prominent figures involved in the spiritualist craze that swept Great Britain and America roughly 100 years ago, Doyle felt, as Barnes puts it, that he was pushing at the ironclad walls of a materialist universe. It's a testament to Bourne's ingenuity as a storyteller that George Adelge's sections never seem to be standing in the shadow of Doyle's larger, more public story, nor do the intersections of the two men's stories feel forced. In George's passages, we readers are transported back into the cloistered childhood of a clever boy in a mixed-race family, a family who's so silently anxious about their status and safety in their provincial English village that, as Barnes describes, even into adulthood, George Adelge sleeps with his father in a locked bedroom while his mother sleeps with his sister. What framework will make human suffering comprehensible? That was chief among the metaphysical mysteries that preoccupied thinkers great and small during the late 19th century as Darwin ushered in the modern age of doubt. Both Arthur and George endured awful personal ordeals. For Arthur, the long fading away of his first wife from consumption and the death of his eldest son in World War I. For George, of course, his wrongful imprisonment and lifelong sentence to loneliness. To make sense of their suffering, both men here grasp at various systems like spiritualism, the law, Christianity, and romantic love, most of which turn out to be nothing but slim reeds. As Doyle was, Barnes, in this powerful novel, seems to be haunted by the omnipresent threat of the great Grimpen Mire, that swamp of formless menace that in The Hound of the Baskervilles so very nearly swallows up our greatest fictional champion of the powers of reason.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Arthur and George by Julian Barnes. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And from GM, committed to energy independence with vehicles that run on 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. Details at onlygm.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new DVD features a concert performance by the late singer Dusty Springfield live at the Royal Albert Hall. On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with her biographer, Vicki Wickham, who was also Springfield's close friend and manager. Join us for the next Fresh Air. That's really what take me walking. Out through the backyard, we go walking.